You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's this month's music column by Lisa Robinson. Tariana Ball of Tank and the Bangas lets the good times roll. Photo illustration by Braulio Amado. Tank and the Bangas members Joshua Johnson, Albert Allenback, Tank, Merrill Burkett, and Norman Spence. I want to be that person to lead the march from what's been going on underground for years and bring it above ground, says the powerful singer, poet, performer Tank, real name Tariana Ball of Tank and the Bangas, the five-piece New Orleans-based funk, soul, jazz, hip-hop collective. Spoken word, song, poetry, adds Tank, all this crazy music that doesn't have a genre. Winners of NPR's 2017 Tiny Desk Contest, Tank and the Bangas have brought their exhilarating stage show to summer festivals, including the upcoming Newport Folk Festival and Red Rocks, and their new album is expected out later this year. Here, Tank opens up about fearlessness, food, and New Orleans. In addition to your amazing singing voice, you're a veteran of the slam poetry scene. How did that start? My sister used to write, and she probably affected me the most as a poet. I became part of a New Orleans slam team that really changed my life because they would sing with their poetry. People made fun of us because they said, all you do is sing. But we come from a city that has music in it. It was just natural to do. When did you first become aware that you had such a strong stage presence? It took a very long time. My pastor told me years ago that I had something special, so I simply just believed him. I'm surrounded by people who still believe in me much more than I believe in myself. But your words and your onstage raps are fearless. You don't hold back. Where does that come from? I find power in vulnerability. Everybody's vulnerable, scared, insecure, in love, everything. We've all felt these things. And it's not about race or being a woman. I want to talk about all that because I know I'm not alone. People are far too concerned with female body image, especially in show business, but you seem very comfortable in your skin. I definitely want to be healthier, but I've just been in the skin for so long. I've been thick for a long time. I have slim friends and I have big friends, and the big girls dress differently, wear different makeup, and are very confident. They live very loudly, and I like those kind of women. I can't deny what's going on in my body. I'm a big girl, and I love to eat a lot. I love clothes that fit me cute. I never want to be a skinny girl, but I definitely want to be in shape. Isn't that hard when you're on the road? Yes, it's horrible food. McDonald's, Burger King. I've been on the road so much that when I come home to New Orleans, where the food is amazing, it's time to indulge. How do you handle being the front woman in a band with four male egos? For the majority of it, they're really cool. I don't just feel like some lead woman. It feels like a big circle. Where I begin, they end, and where I end, they begin. I write these songs, but they write the music to them. I'm not about to do an entire show a cappella. We make this big sound, and we're really proud of that. But we love to calm it down and do acoustic sets, too. Low and beautiful and really dynamic. What's it like living in the South now with what's going on politically? The people I hang around with in New Orleans are artists, poets, revolutionaries, speakers, and everyone is very passionate about feminism and Black Lives Matter. You become aware. But the beauty part of my world is I can invite people into this place we call the Funhouse. We have so much fun on stage. It really is an escape from all the rest of the bullcrap. I don't think about Trump every day. I think about the music. Brett Hinemuth reports from the fairground. Vanity Fair and Max Mara fet the future of women in film. In the photos, Alexandra Shipp and Giorgio Guidotti, DJ Mia Moretti, Kelsey Asbill, Krista Smith and Maria Giulia Marmotti, the garden at the Chateau Marmont, Radhika Jones and January Jones, Abigail Spencer, Jackie Ton and Erica Christensen, Nikki Hilton Rothschild. The winds of change swept the Hollywood Hills last month at an intimate garden party that brought emerging talent and venerable vets to the Chateau Marmont Hotel. Just weeks after 82 female actresses, directors, producers, and cinematographers marched the red carpet at the Cannes Film Festival in support of gender equality, Vanity Fair joined with Italian fashion house Max Mara and the Women in Film organization to support female representation in Hollywood and toast this year's Face of the Future recipient, actress Alexandra Shipp. "I can't believe it," beamed Shipp, the first African-American woman to receive the award. "2 years ago, I came to the same party early and didn't know anyone." The actress, who starred in X-Men, Apocalypse, and Love, Simon, and will soon lead the Shaft reboot with Samuel L. Jackson, co-hosted with Vanity Fair's executive West Coast editor Krista Smith, and Max Mara's global brand ambassador, Maria Giulia Marmonti. Vanity Fair editor Radhika Jones conversed with industry heavyweights, including producer Jennifer Todd and Netflix's documentary doyenne Lisa Nishimura. Also mingling in the crowd were screen queens Suki Waterhouse, Carson Meyer, and Pam Clementiff, while Riverdale's co-eds mixed with Glow Gals and Hulu's Handmaids. Surveying the next class of Hollywood Wonder Women, Todd remarked, "This rising generation represents an important shift in our industry and the world at large. There's still work to be done, but I'm inspired by the future wave of storytellers." From Sonia Soraya comes this article, 20 and Fabulous. The brilliantly superficial Sex and the City series ended romance as we knew it, which is fine. Photo illustration by Michelle Thompson. Carry on. Sex and the City with Sarah Jessica Parker, Kristen Davis, Cynthia Nixon, and Kim Cattrall paved the way for today's single girls subgenre. Sex and the City, which debuted 20 years ago this summer, was not simply a TV series. It was a phenomenon, a comedy, a fashion Bible, a trend report, a manual to New York, a lifestyle manifesto. Its success and its cultural footprint can be attributed to several factors that amounted to a perfect storm. Frank and provocative subject matter, ultra-contemporary fad spotting, and an arch, old-fashioned tone that sometimes laughed with its sexually adventurous characters, but more often laughed at them. Sex and the City had no compunctions about being wish fulfillment. If anything, it reveled in the implausibility of its own world. Where a practically freelance sex columnist regularly wore $400 shoes, and a gallerina intent on nabbing a husband wouldn't deign to give blowjobs. The stylish and upscale leads were only occasionally tethered to the rules of the rest of society, usually through the self-reflective voiceover of lead Carrie Bradshaw, Sarah Jessica Parker, who asked questions like, "Are we sluts?" as she pined for a longer-lasting romance than the zipless Fs that made up most of the series' adventures. But despite Carrie's rumination, Sex and the City was never an angsty, gritty, or even especially thoughtful show. Every time the series uncovered remarkable complexity at the root of its fun, it found twice as many opportunities to make its untethered girls the butt of its humor. It eventually admitted the financial limitations of some of its characters, most famously in the episode where Charlotte, Kristen Davis, helps Carrie make a down payment to buy her apartment. But class privilege is just the tip of the iceberg. In its 6 years on the air, the show barely acknowledged the overwhelming whiteness and straightness of its cast, and when it did, the results were usually disastrous. The series wouldn't even kowtow to the reality of the weather. For 4 years, Sex and the City never depicted a season other than spring. In the two decades since, the single girls of the Post, Sex and the City, small screen, care less about style and more about substance than those in creator Darren Star's frothy, superficial world. They're poorer, messier, less white, and less straight. From Insecure's Issa Rae, to 30 Rock's Liz Lemon, Tina Fey, The Mindy Project's Mindy Lahiri, Mindy Kaling, Broad City's Yana and Abby, Yana Glazer, Abby Jacobson, Fleabag's unnamed lead, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and of course, the girls of girls. Less than a decade removed from the New York of Sex and the City, yet apparently light years away. The obvious limitations of its fantasies, though, are part of what made and make Sex and the City so endlessly engrossing. More than once, the show ridicules its leads for expecting the rest of the world to work the way that their New York does. Even so, the series presented an unfettered fantasy of desire. It was a manual for living shamelessly, in the best sense of the word. No wonder the show had complete disinterest in even the pose of being woke, or whatever the equivalent term was in 1998. Deep down, it didn't really care about anything except living out the fantasies of modern life in the 90s and early aughts. Sex, dating, New York's hottest clubs, and expensive things, which altogether made for a years-long secondary story told entirely through wardrobes, workout classes, and impulse vacations. Sex and the City's World right to the end was a flight of fancy, but its legacy points away from that and toward a post-romantic comedy world where fantasies have to succumb to everyday realities. Girls, which succeeded Sex and the City on HBO and in some ways supplanted it, presented a similarly bleak romantic playing field in Lena Dunham's version of New York City, but one studded with much more angst. And in Secure, the third line in the HBO Single Girls in the City chain, the third link in the HBO Single Girls in the City chain, ended its second season with its protagonist going broke, after her attempts to live out her dreams were met with the cold realities of her finances. Where Sex and the City skated through everything with a laugh and a trill, fabulous, the shows that followed have found a way to examine and redefine what it might mean for a girl to have it all, or at the very least, to find a happy ending.
Thank you.
From the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion and events. Experience, Succession on HBO. The new HBO drama series, Succession, follows the Roy family, owners of one of the biggest media empires in the world, as they prepare to transition control of the company to the next generation. From Adam McKay, director of The Big Short, and In the Loop writer Jesse Armstrong, Succession airs Sundays at 10 p.m., only on HBO. Shop Automatic Tourbillon Talisman, with a name that evokes nothing less than magical protection, Richard Mille's new collection of high jewelry timepieces for women pays tribute to influences from tribal arts and the Art Deco era. The RM7101 Automatic Tourbillon Talisman, available in 10 different dial designs that feature combinations of diamonds, mother of pearl, onyx, and black sapphires set in gold, also represents the Swiss manufacturer's first tourbillon caliber that is automatic rather than hand-wound. The timepiece weaves together the cutting-edge technicity specific to Richard Mille with the unique sculptural qualities of fine art jewelry while highlighting their respective strengths. Shop Creative Edge, not just another chicken dinner. Creative Edge Parties is the leading culinary production company creating fully immersive food experiences for events. With kitchens in New York's West Village and Miami's Design District, Creative Edge has the ability to produce events across the country. Creative Edge creates once-only experiences that deliver culinary, visual, and marketing goals. The design team and chef produce events that equally focus on food and presentation. With ownership in restaurants, an exclusive event space within Chelsea Market, and a dedicated 10,000-square-foot design studio, Creative Edge is constantly reinventing the notion of event cuisine.
Thank you.
The Lear of Beverly Hills. By most accounts, Sumner Redstone never wanted his daughter, Sherry, to get control of his media empire, but she is emerging victorious, disrupting the companies and putting his life's work at risk. By William D. Cohan. Photo illustration by Sean McCabe. Three's a crowd. Sumner Redstone's failing health has left his daughter, Sherry, at odds with CBS CEO Leslie Moonves. A decade ago, when he was still somewhat spry, Sumner Redstone had an existential crisis. The shocking collapse of Lehman Brothers was still reverberating through the capital markets, and the Redstone family's holding company, National Amusements Incorporated, which owned nearly 80% of the voting stock in both CBS and Viacom, was larded up with some $1.6 billion in unsecured debt. Covenants in the debt had been breached. To satisfy the banks, Redstone unexpectedly sold $233 million worth of National Amusements non-voting stock in CBS and Viacom. But he still wasn't out of financial trouble. Over the years, he had also bought, on margin, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shares in WMS Industries, a slot machine maker, and Midway Games, which had been spun off from WMS. Redstone was particularly hot for Midway, maker of the video game Mortal Kombat, after deciding that gaming was the next big thing. He spent around $700 million on Midway shares, until he owned 87% of the company. At one point, his stake was worth more than $1.8 billion. But in the wake of the financial crisis, the Midway stock was trading for pennies. In December 2008, he sold his entire holding for $100,000. Faced with significant margin calls, Redstone wanted to sell movie theaters that National Amusements owned. To complete the sale of what had been the family's original business, he needed the approval of his daughter, Sherry, who had received 20% of National Amusements as part of the divorce settlement between Sumner and her mother years before. But Sherry blocked her father from selling most of the theaters. As a result, Sumner had no choice but to sell more CBS and Viacom stock at a time when they were severely depressed, given the market turmoil. The move cost the family more than $1 billion as the market recovered. To say that Sumner was pissed at his daughter's intransigence would be an understatement. According to one person who has known Sumner for years, he often referred to her in vulgar terms. Perhaps more importantly, says a longtime friend of Sumner's, it showed that she was not the CEO-type thinker that he needed going forward. A decade later, with Sumner Redstone 95 years old and incapacitated, the conflict between father and daughter has been sharpened as never before. Seemingly, without Sumner's full awareness, an assertion that Sherry and her attorneys deny, Sherry has taken control of National Amusements and has also started imposing her will on both CBS and Viacom, attempting to force a merger that has sunk CBS stock and launched an extraordinary King Lear drama that is playing out in Manhattan, where CBS and Viacom are headquartered, and in the Delaware Court of Chancery, where CBS and Sherry have been locked in a pitched legal battle. In May, the CBS Board of Directors voted 11-3 to issue a massive number of stock dividends that, if approved by Judge Andre Bouchard, would dilute the Redstone voting stake in CBS to a still formidable 17%. But down from an insurmountable 80% and effectively preventing her from railroading through a merger. The trouble really started, however, at Sumner's mansion in Beverly Hills. Cognizant that Sumner wanted little to do with his daughter or her family, too much younger women, Sidney Holland and Manuela Herzer enveloped him in his home for years. Holland was Sumner's girlfriend. Herzer was a former girlfriend and longtime companion. Meanwhile, Sumner tried at least twice to buy his daughter's 20% stake in National Amusements for around $1 billion, but no deal was reached. Holland's and Herzer's grip on Sumner tightened, and eventually he gave them around $75 million each for their troubles. Sherry's luck began to change in 2015, when Holland was caught having an affair with a former soap opera actor, George Pilgrim, in Sedona, Arizona. Holland would occasionally leave Beverly Hills in the morning on a private jet, using Sumner's credit card, fly to Sedona to see Pilgrim, and then fly back to Beverly Hills the same day, without Sumner being the wiser. When he found out, he kicked her out of his house. A few months later, in October 2015, he also dispensed with Herzer, after Sherry apparently convinced him that Herzer was committing elder abuse. Sumner filed an elder abuse lawsuit against Holland and Herzer, seeking a return of the money he had given each woman. Holland has settled the litigation with the Redstones. The suit against Herzer, who denies the allegations of elder abuse, is ongoing. With the two women gone, and Sumner allegedly losing cognition rapidly, Sherry and her lawyers revised legal documents, giving her control of National Amusements and its controlling stakes in CBS and Viacom. In court filings, Herzer alleged that Sumner Redstone's signature was forged. His attorneys adamantly dispute the allegations and deny that Sumner is losing cognition. With her newfound authority, Sherry set about making changes to both the Viacom and the CBS boards. Where she has really wreaked havoc, though, has been in her desire to smash CBS and Viacom back together. In 1999, Viacom bought CBS for $35.6 billion. In 2006, Sumner decided there was no longer any industrial logic to keep the two companies together and split them into two separately traded companies. Once upon a time, Sherry, too, supported the idea that Viacom and CBS should be two separate companies, a viewpoint she articulated in various interviews with journalists. But now, Sherry wants them together again, perhaps as a way for her to one day sell the family stock in both companies in a tax-efficient manner. Her first attempt to force the merger fell apart in December 2016. Starting last August, she tried again. Her logic was that the two companies were subscale in a rapidly consolidating media landscape. This time, Sherry appeared smarter. She went without a strategy that disavowed the optics. She went about a strategy that disavowed the optics of interference in the merger process, a no-no under Delaware law. Each company set up a special committee of its board of directors and hired bankers and lawyers to negotiate a deal. Sherry's friends were added to the Viacom special committee. They wanted to do a deal. The CBS committee membership was approved by Sherry. Over time, and under pressure from Sherry, the two committees agreed to an economic deal that valued Viacom at around $12 billion in CBS stock. But agreeing on a valuation for Viacom was only one part of the complex equation. Sherry made clear to CBS CEO Leslie Moonves, who was slated to head the combined company, that she wanted Bob Bakish, the CEO of Viacom, and an ardent loyalist to be on the board of the combined company. Moonves said no. A source familiar with the situation speculated that Moonves feared yet another sherry crony in his midst. Through the process of trying to reach a deal, the animosity between Sherry and Moonves, who had once been allies, intensified. Leaks were rampant, according to a complaint filed by CBS, and usually involved the implication that if the CBS Special Committee did not recommend a deal, Sherry would replace the directors on the CBS board with ones who would. There were also stories that Moonves could be fired if he did not agree to a deal with Viacom. In court filings, CBS argued that Sherry was the source of the leaks. National Amusements and attorneys for Sherry Redstone have denied any intention to replace CBS directors or Moonves. Finally, in May, came the stunning CBS board vote to issue a stock dividend to dilute the Redstone family's voting stake in CBS, and a request to have Judge Bouchard ratify the move. CBS attorneys wrote in a complaint that at the decisive board meeting, Moonves stated he did not think he could successfully lead CBS anymore, given Sherry's alleged meddling. Recently, a National Amusements complaint, filed after CBS's complaint, suggested that Sherry was now considering abandoning the deal, given Moonves's reluctance. Sumner Redstone was always careful to wield his considerable power offstage, making clear his preferences, but rarely letting any disagreements go public. But it's all about Sherry now. If anybody really thought that the father anointed the daughter, they would be absolutely nuts, says the longtime Sumner friend. There's just no way. There was such animosity, such feelings, and a lack of trust in her judgment that the father had, that he would never, ever, ever, unless he went insane, have said to put the daughter back in.
Thank you.
Now the Proust Questionnaire, with an illustration by Risco, Angela Bassett, the activist and Black Panther actress who stars in this summer's Mission Impossible Fallout, talks procrastination, T'Challa, and changing the world. What is your idea of perfect happiness, living in peace? What is your greatest fear, poverty? Which historical figure do you most identify with, Sojourner Truth? Which living person do you most admire, Barack Obama? What is the trait you most deplore in yourself, insecurity? What is the trait you most deplore in others, self-centeredness? What is your greatest extravagance, travel? What is your favorite journey, the journey to falling in love? What do you consider the most overrated virtue, beauty? On what occasion do you lie? I really try not to lie, but I will admit to sometimes omitting facts when I think the situation requires it. What do you dislike most about your appearance, my neck? Which words or phrases do you most overuse, awesome? What is your greatest regret, not doing more theater? What or who is the greatest love of your life? My aunt, Golden B. Wall. Which talent would you most like to have? Playing an instrument, either guitar or piano. What is your current state of mind? Very relaxed. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to practice less procrastination. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My children, Bronwyn and Slater. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? An innovator whose contributions help to change the world for the betterment of mankind. What is your most treasured possession? My artwork collection. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Hopelessness. Where would you like to live? Wherever I find myself. What is your favorite occupation? Acting, of course. What is your most marked characteristic? Mercy and compassion. What is the quality you most like in a man? Reliability. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Loyalty. What do you most value in your friends? Wisdom and joy. Who is your favorite writer? Zora Neale Hurston. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? That's easy, T'Challa. Who are your heroes in real life? Jubilant and Golden. What is it that you most dislike? Malicious gossip. What is your motto? I have two. Life is, you can't dance to every record, and God bless you real good. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Angela Bassett.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.